And now the man that Forbes magazine once called the greatest sports agent in history, Lee Steinberg. Lee has a new book out that looks at pro football in a way most of us have never seen it before. That book is titled The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. Lee Steinberg, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
You represented one of the most loved players in Kansas City Chiefs history, Lee, Derek Thomas. And get this, he called you to represent him. That call was in the winter of 1990, just after he finished his rookie season out here. What do you recall about that phone call?
So I got a call from Derek Thomas, who had been, I think, the fifth pick in the first round in the 89 draft.
Yeah, sounds right.
And he asked me if I'd represent him. And I said, well, Derek, look, try to make it right with your old representative. And if you're irrevocably broken, then I'd consider it. And I thought I'd never hear from him again. And sure enough, about a year later, he called. He was one of the most interesting, charismatic athletes I ever worked with. And we were able to set up a program in Kansas City called Third and Long that dealt with kids reading, because he had been dyslexic. And so here you have someone who stands next to President Clinton speaking for the lives of all young people who lost a parent in Vietnam.
You described Derek Thomas, Lee, as unlike any other client I ever had. Why was that?
Well, Derek could walk into a room, and within about 5 minutes, he was intimate friends with every single person there. He could have been student body president of the NFL. He had relationships at every level. I mean, he was tied in with the governor and senators from Missouri. He testified on Capitol Hill in terms of literacy. And here you have someone who comes straight out on the field, makes 9 straight Pro Bowls, and had that miraculous game against Seattle where he sacked Dave Craig
seven times. I remember that game very well. You write in here that his death in 2000 at age 33, I can't believe it's already been, you know, 14 years ago, hurt more than I can ever describe. And you gave one of the eulogies at his funeral. What did you say about him that day?
Well, I think I started out by saying that if Derek was here, he wouldn't be in the building yet because he was chronically late. And he touched so many lives and was an exemplar as an athlete and as a role model in so many different ways. And his phone book looked like a who's who of America. He had that type of charisma to him. And then I remember being in the hospital in Miami, and it looked as if he wouldn't be able to use his legs, but otherwise he's okay. And then out of nowhere, a clot got into his system and killed him. It was just horrible. I did get the chance to go up to Canton when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and the family had a big party I spoke at. So his mom's done a great job, and Third and Long lives on.
You know, all this goes to a point I want to make about your relationship with the clients that you had, Lee, and that is that this was, you know, these were way more than just an ordinary business relationship. Describe those relationships to us.
You have a young man, and the first key is to understand and use listening skills to draw them out so you can, and men don't share so easily. Mm-hmm. So it's necessary to create enough quiet and trust that they'll lay out their priorities, which you can clearly understand how short-term economics and long-term economic security and being a starter and living in a certain geographical location, and to be able to get inside them and figure out their greatest hopes and dreams and greatest anxieties and fears so you can fulfill that person individually. So we would start with the charitable and community option that they have, which was 112 of those athletes set up a scholarship fund at their high schools, a way to lay down roots. And then at the collegiate level, a number of players have linked back into that community by endowing scholarships, a Troy Aikman at UCLA or Steve Young at BYU. Then at the pro level, we asked that athletes find some cause deep in their heart that they'd like to tackle. So Daron Cherry in Kansas City had the Cherry Foundation, and Daron then goes on to own the Anheuser-Busch distributorship there. And then we introduce him to Wayne Weaver, who's buying Jacksonville, and Daron ends up being the first retired player.
I was going to say, he was the first. You say that in the book about him, yeah.
Right, to be a minority owner of a team. So I just had Warwick Dunn, who played for Tampa Bay and Atlanta, send the 134th single woman and her family into the first home they'll ever own by making a down payment and then having Home Depot outfit it. So they can be terrific role models. And to your point, the relationships end up extremely close. So when Warren Moon got inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2006, he asked me to be his presenter.
Lee Steinberg is our guest. He's been described as the greatest sports agent in history. His new book, The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game. Lee, what do agents do exactly?
I'm sure many people are asking that question, Steve. It's the first key is to take a player through the scouting system to get to the draft. So I just had Garrett Gilbert from SMU, the quarterback. They're not really rules. So if you take a high college player, the first thing he'll do is go through a training program postseason in January, early February for the NFL. Those decisions are the athletes. He then can play in all-star games. He can go to the scouting combine and then pro scouting day. So the first job is to make sure that a player gets the best showcase possible to entice teams into drafting him. I've had 60 first-round draft picks in football, and the very first pick in the first round, eight different years, and half the starting. And that's how you get them there. Now, the negotiations themselves, and remind me to tell you a good Carl Peterson cave story about Kansas City.
Okay.
The actual negotiations for a football rookie or a basketball rookie are completely constricted. We have salary caps. So all the creativity that I used to use in doing voids in a contract or void buybacks or escalators or all the creative things that you can get when you lock five lawyers into a room and don't feed them till they come out with ways to break the cap, all gone. So not much negotiation to do, but the next step would be mentoring, making sure that player understands how to fit into the team, keeps his confidence up, charitable community programs, endorsements. When you get to the second contract, that's where the big negotiability begins.
You know, well, tell me the Carl Peterson story that involves a cave.
So Lamar Hunt owned a whole series of underground caves in Kansas City.
Well, they're still out there, yeah.
But please don't think of it like in Tom Sawyer.
You know, no, I've been in them.
It's like a city with actual street names underneath Kansas City. It's very eerie. So I'm a little bit claustrophobic. I mean, not completely, but just enough to make it uncomfortable to be enclosed and crowded. So I was negotiating for Derek with Carl Peterson, and he took me to the caves to do it. And they were like limestone all around us.
Yeah, sure.
So every minute, that limestone wall got closer and closer to me. And the room was like imploding. And I finally said, Carl, we'll take whatever you offer. Just get me out of these caves.
And did he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he loved Derek, and so those were not difficult negotiations.
You know, you tell a great story in this book about signing Steve Young, who still is a commentator for the NFL, to a contract with the old USFL League, and this was the LA Express back in the day. You had a goal of surpassing the $1 million a year contract that John Elway had received, and you wound up going way, way, way beyond that to a $42 million deal. You had no idea you were going to wind up getting that much money. How did you do that?
This was the intersection of the battle between the USFL and the NFL. And if the USFL had just held on, history shows that there's so much television money, they would have done just fine. But at that point, they had signed Herschel Walker and Reggie White, and they picked the NFL draft clean. They needed a vibrant franchise in Los Angeles. And we're a front-running, celebrity-loving city, and which I can say because this is only going to Kansas City. And and what happened is that they needed a charismatic person like Steve. So all he wanted to do was play in the NFL, and all he wanted to do was participate. Cincinnati had the first pick, and they had Ken Anderson, so he saw where that future was going to be. So we start the negotiation, and they've made a sell to him based on, this is your best developmental place as a quarterback. We've got John Hadle and Sid Gilman, architect of the modern passing game. But I get to Don Klosterman's house.
Who was the general manager for the LA Express, right?
Yes. And so we're in this gorgeous mansion up on the in the Hollywood Hills looking out over the lights. Well, we just kept going, and it was easy. I just kept saying no.
Yes.
And and I would call the Youngs, and they would say no. So now all of a sudden it's 5 o'clock, 6, 7, 8, and this continues. Once we'd gone seriously over the money that Elway had gotten the year before, we knew that we had to do something to add more money, but not current tax dollars. So we added a $35 million annuity on a $37 million. So all of a sudden it was $42 million. And Steve Young, who just wanted to perform, was not really into anything ostentatious, ends up being held up as a symbol of sports economics run amok. And it leads the Dan Rather Nightly News and headlines all around the world. And the irony of his career was all he wanted to do is participate. And he had the Express and then Tampa, and then he has to sit behind Joe Montana.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But you're saying there wasn't lots of great skill involved as an agent for Steve Young. All you did was keep saying no, and the numbers just kept going up.
That's right. My young daughter could have done that negotiation. She could have followed the script. I just would have written N-O on the paper in front of her and just tell her anytime there was a pause, say that word.
Well, the story almost gets better. At one point in the process, after you had agreed to all the numbers, as you would do for anybody, you sort of had to carefully walk through the contract to make sure that no mistakes had been made. And the owner of the Express, again, Bill Oldenburg, he was a very impatient man, used to making deals very, very quickly. Exactly how impatient did Bill Oldenburg become, Lee?
So we're going through the details of the contract. No one bothered to brief Bill Oldenburg for the fact this can take hours or a couple days, which is just normal. But it was his birthday that night, and we're in his headquarters in downtown San Francisco, where he has a big gong every time they do a $1 million deal. And he's wants to go out for his birthday dinner, but we're not getting done. So at one point he walks in and says, "What are the issues here? I want this done." And he said, one of his people responded, "It's guarantees." So he takes a big wad of $100 bills and throws them at me and says, "Here's all the guarantees you'll ever need." And then it progressed and progressed. So finally he became so dissatisfied, he calls Steve and I up to his office, and he says, "I've offered you the biggest contract in history of sports, and you're balking. You may not be my guy." And he starts popping his finger into Steve's chest.
Yes.
And at one point, Steve grabs his arm and says, "You do that one more time, I'm going to deck you." And so, and he started trying to throw chairs out the window. So we were unceremoniously deposited via security guards onto the streets of San Francisco at 3:30 in the morning.
It was dark. There's nobody out there, and there you are, right?
Yeah, there we are. And Steve, at that point, is a young, naive, pale-faced person who's been at BYU, and he had no way to process any of it.
Lee Steinberg is our guest. He's been called the greatest sports agent in history. His new book is titled The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. I've been slow getting out our phone number. I've been so engrossed in the conversation. 816-235-2888. If you want to give us a call with a question for Lee Steinberg, 816-235-2888. You know, Lee, to what extent is the price for any player pretty much established just by virtue of where he's drafted, what number pick he is, the 14th pick in the draft, the 28th pick in the draft? I'm thinking, you know, that the 12th player in the draft gets so much money, then the 14th player is slotted to get, you know, maybe just a little bit less. Is it really that simple these days?
Well, in 2011, the NFL engaged in a new CBA, and the NBA had already had a similar system. So before that, we could freely negotiate massive amounts of money for rookies. They made a strategic change in the new collective bargaining agreement to make sure that the money was saved for proven productive starters, mm-hmm. and went to benefits. And so today, that rookie negotiation is pro forma. It's the second negotiation in basketball and football, and obviously baseball is an age-oriented sport, so it's when you get 6 years in baseball. And then in all of those sports, the negotiations are, again, creative and interesting and all the rest, just not for rookies.
Hey, do you agree with that system, the way it's been restructured in the NFL, Lee?
I think it's hard philosophically to argue with the concept that proven productive starters in sports ought to make the major amount of money. Doesn't work quite as well in baseball because in the first 3 years, a player can be renewed. So we had Mike Trout playing here for the Angels making $700,000 when he's like in the top three MVP.
Yeah.
But yes, it's a fairer system. The worst aspect of all of this is the injuries the players suffer. And I had a crisis of conscience back in the 80s because I would see that our quarterbacks in football were having head injuries. No one could tell us from the medical side exactly what the long-term consequences were or when they should retire. So I started holding concussion conferences in Newport Beach in the 90s, held three of them, made sure the athletes were there, and then not much change. In 2007, Warren Moon and I with the Concussion Institute did a panel where we had neurologists tell us that three or more is a magic trigger point and that it created an exponentially higher rate of Alzheimer's, ALS, premature senility, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So I called it a ticking time bomb and an undiagnosed health epidemic. Mm-hmm. Steve, I now believe that every time an offensive lineman hits a defensive lineman at the inception of every football play, it produces a low-level subconcussive event.
Wow.
So you could have an offensive lineman walk out of football with 10,000 subconcussive hits, none of which were diagnosed or he's aware of, and the aggregate of which is much, much worse than getting knocked out three times. So bigger, stronger, faster players. So it's an existential threat to football because if 50% of the mothers in the country say to their teenage boys, you can play any sport you want but not tackle football, it won't kill football. It'll just change the socioeconomics of it so that the same people play football who currently box, knowing that there's a high risk of brain damage, but seeing it as their opportunity to get out of economic deprivation.
Well, why won't it kill football, Lee? I mean, given what you're describing here, the gravity of the situation, why won't this kill the NFL?
Because they will still be able to find people who will play the game. By 2-1, the NFL is the most popular sport today. There were estimates that 20% of the computers being used during last football season in businesses were used to play fantasy football. And three of the top five shows in the Nielsen's many weeks were nighttime NFL football. A pregame show, Football in America, outrated 97 other forms of entertainment.
Yeah. You know, your book also talks about sort of the downside that you went through. You've had all these amazing successes, but also these setbacks. You lost, here's the list. You lost two houses to mold. Two of your kids were diagnosed with severe vision problems. You squandered a fortune in the internet crash. You and your wife struggled and then finally divorced. You lost your dad to cancer. And then you turned to alcohol and had your own struggles there. How could someone who had so much, Lee, manage to lose so much too?
The part of it that I deeply regretted was the loss of relationships. As to the financial side of that, we didn't just squander the money. Like a huge amount of money went into a training program to stop racism and anti-Semitism. We spent a prodigious amount. But what happened was that I felt powerless and couldn't protect my dad, couldn't protect my boys, couldn't hold a marriage together. So I cycled down. And by 2010, I had an epiphany that my dad had two core values. One was treasure relationships, especially family. And the second was to try to make a positive impact in the world and help people who couldn't help themselves. Neither of those things I was accomplishing. So I went into sober living, worked a 12-step program with a unique fellowship, and now I'm in my fifth year of sobriety.
Good for you.
And we relaunched earlier this year. And matter of fact, I'm just finishing what's been a four-month book tour. And so I think every day is a blessing now. I didn't understand addiction then. And the reason I've been so public with all this is in the hope that if there's someone out there who's feeling hopeless and overwhelmed, that they can see that there is a way back.
You know, Lee, I've got to ask you in just a few seconds we have left about Jerry Maguire, the movie. The most famous line, of course, from that film is Cuba Gooding shouting to Jerry Maguire, who's played by Tom Cruise, "Show me the money." But you never said those words. Where did they come from?
So Cameron Crowe followed me around the director for about a year and a half. And one of the places we went was the NFL League meetings. Tim McDonald was a free safety looking for a home. At night, Cameron took Tim and asked him while he was researching, "What are you looking for in this experience?" Lou Dobbs and Moneyline was on in the background. So Tim gestures towards the screen and says, "I'm looking for a team to show me respect. I'm looking for a team that will show me security. I'm looking for a team that will show me winning." And Cameron wrote the line, "Show me the money."
There you go. What a great story. Lee Steinberg is the author of The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. Lee, what a pleasure. Continued great success. Good luck on your own journey, and so good to have you here.
Thanks, and hi to all my friends in Kansas City.
You bet, Lee. Sure appreciate it.